Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer günstig und natürlich mit dem Aldi-Tiefpreisversprechen. Zum Beispiel knackiges Gemüse, saftiges Obst, frische Backwaren. Kurz gesagt, mehr Frische für alle. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote zum Tiefpreis in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
For a long time, people have been telling me that the bestial version of the Wendigo, with the skull head and antlers, is actually the Wechuge, a cannibalistic creature from the mythology of the Athabascan or Diné peoples. And tonight I've decided to read what I've gathered so far over the years. Stories about Wechuges, or at least stories that sound like they're about them. Now I was about one story short of a full script, so this episode's going to be between 45 and 50 minutes long. Forgive me, I'll make it up on the next one. For now, enjoy. This is Unexplained Encounters, and I'm your host, Darkness Prevails. And these are allegedly real encounters with the Wechuge. Don't forget to send me your scary stories of the unexplained at darkstories.org. Follow and review Unexplained Encounters on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And pre-order a copy of Creepy Campfire Stories on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or go to creepycampfirestories.com. Thank you. Now, let's begin. Uncle Roy and the Wechuge. From Whoops. My Uncle Roy died last spring. His liver gave out, which surprised nobody. The surprising part was the box of journals they found in his cabin near Fort Chipewyan. 40 years of entries, most barely legible. They had whiskey stains on half the pages. Mom asked me to go through them, see if there was something worth keeping before she burned the lot. Drunk ramblings mostly, complaints about his back and the government, the price of gas. But the winter of 1987 was different. The handwriting was steadier there, the entries longer and more detailed. It was like he needed to get it down right, even though he clearly tried to forget it for decades. It was early February. He'd gone ice fishing with his friend, Terence Pelletier, out on Lake Clair, about 4 hours by snowmobile from town. They'd been going to the same spot for years, a little pressure ridge where the lake ice buckled up, creating a natural windbreak. A great spot for lake trout, if you could drill through 3 feet of ice to reach them. The first day was pretty normal. They set up the portable shelter and drilled their holes, settling in with coffee and sandwiches. They caught a few decent trout. The only thing, Roy wrote, was how oddly quiet things were that day. How windless it was, which was unusual for February. He wrote it was so odd that they found themselves whispering their conversations. That night in the shelter, Terence mentioned seeing someone else out on the ice earlier. Way off to the north, just a dark figure against the white. Roy hadn't seen anything, but Terence insisted. He said whoever it was had been moving real strange, and by that he meant, instead of walking, it looked like they were sliding. They talked about who else might be out here. The lake was huge, and there were lots of good fishing spots. But most people stuck closer to town in the winter. 4 hours out was serious backcountry. Could be someone from one of the villages up north, Terence suggested. Some of the old-timers still ran trap lines out that way. The second day, they both saw him. Or it. Roy couldn't decide which word to use, even riding weeks later. It was maybe a kilometer away, moving along the shoreline. They discussed whether it was a bear at first. The size was right, and it was dark against the snow. But bears didn't walk upright like that, not constantly, and they sure as heck didn't move that smoothly. Roy wrote that it looked like someone skiing almost, with the way it glided. Except there were no poles, no skis, just this huge figure sliding along the ice like it was greased. Terrence wanted to snowmobile over to see who it was. Roy talked him out of it, said it was a bad idea. They didn't know who or what it was, and whether or not it was dangerous. They watched it until it disappeared behind a point of land. They spent the rest of the day fishing with one eye on the horizon. The fishing was terrible. Neither of them could concentrate. They packed up early, heading back to the shelter before dark. That night was when things got bad. Roy wrote that he woke up around 2 a.m., needing to relieve himself. He crawled out of his sleeping bag and unzipped the shelter door. The moon was almost full, bright enough to cast shadows on the ice, bright enough to see the trail of footprints that circled their camp. They weren't footprints exactly as he looked closer. Looked more like drag marks, as if someone had been pulling themselves around their shelter with their hands, legs trailing behind. The marks went around and around, spiral pattern getting closer with each pass. The closest ones were maybe 10 feet from the shelter wall. Roy woke Terrence quietly. They loaded the rifles they brought for bears, sitting there in the dark shelter and listening. There was nothing for an hour. Then, just as they were starting to relax, they heard ice creaking. Not the normal settling sounds, a rhythmic creaking. Someone was approaching. Something brushed against the shelter wall then. The whole structure shook. Terrence started to unzip the door to look out, but Roy stopped him. They waited, hardly breathing. There was another brush against the wall, harder this time, then nothing. They didn't sleep the rest of the night. At first light, they went outside to check things out. The drag marks were still there, but now there were other marks too. Some handprints in the snow that didn't look human. The fingers were too long, and everywhere the hands had touched, the snow had been melted and refrozen. How could something out here be so hot? They should have left then. Roy wrote that he knew they should leave, that whatever guardian angel he had was begging him to just go. But Terrence insisted that they were just being stupid. They were afraid of shadows. At worst, it was a hermit trying to scare them off his favorite fishing spot. They had driven 4 hours to get there. Might as well get one more day of fishing in. So they stayed. They drilled new holes closer to camp, kept the rifles loaded and close, tried to pretend everything was normal. Around noon, Terrence's line went tight. Not the steady pull of a trout. This was violent jerking, like he'd hooked something huge. He was laughing, excited, and working that rod as best he could. And then the line went slack. He reeled in fast, swearing up a storm, saying that this was going to be his one that got away. But there was something on the line still. Not a fish. There was a hair. A long, black, human-like hair wrapped around the hook, frozen into clumps. That's when they truly saw it for the first time. It rose up through one of the old fishing holes from the day before, maybe 30 yards away. Roy's description took up 3 full pages, like he needed to record every detail to prove to himself it had been real. It was a man, and then it wasn't. And whatever it was naked, despite the killing cold. Its skin looked frozen, blue-white, with patches of black frostbite. Or maybe not frostbite, because the black areas moved, or maybe pulsated. It stood about 7 feet tall at least, and was thin, with ribs showing through awful skin. Its hair was matted and frozen and hanging down its back. The face was the worst part. Human features that had been stretched and pulled tight over a skull that was much too large, and eyes that were too white, with no iris, no pupil, as if even the eyes had frozen solid. And the mouth, Roy wrote. The mouth never closed, It just hung open, jaw distended, ice crystals forming and melting on blue lips. It stood there, water running off its body and freezing instantly when it hit the ice. It watched them, swaying slightly, then made an odd noise like it was trying to speak. Roy said it sounded like someone talking through broken glass. Whatever it said, Terrence understood something in it because he dropped his fishing rod and backed away toward the snowmobiles. The creature moved then, dropping to all fours, and it came at them across the ice. That same sliding motion from before, but now they were horribly close. It pulled itself forward with those long arms, its body dragging behind way too fast. They ran for the snowmobiles, got them started, a miracle that they started so fast in the cold, and they took off. Garrett looked back once and saw it following, looking like some massive broken spider. He wrote that he could hear it over the engine noise, a laughing or crying sound of some sort, maybe both at the same time. They made it back to town. They told everyone what they saw. Terrence soon after sold his ice fishing gear and refused to go back out. About 5 years after that, he died in a car accident. But Roy wrote that Terrence had called him the night before he died, said he'd been having dreams about the lake, about something under the ice waiting for him. Roy actually went back once, one summer. He took a boat out to where they'd camped. The pressure ridge was gone. Ice formations never last season to season. But he found something else. There were bones scattered along the shore. Not animal bones. Too big. Looked human. Some had teeth marks. He didn't write what kind of teeth left marks like that, though. The last entry about that winter was short. Roy had talked to some people, some elders in the town. An old Cree woman told him about the Wechuge, people who ate human flesh in winter and became monsters. They would be cast out from their villages, but they couldn't die. The hunger and cold would transform them into something else. Something that lived under the ice, waiting for fishermen, trappers, anyone alone on the lake. She told him he was lucky. The Wechuge had been playing with them. When it was really hungry, she said, you would never see it coming. They would just find a hole in the ice where someone used to be. These are the stories my grandmother used to tell. From Anonymous. My grandmother Eva was Cree, from northern Alberta. And she had this way of telling stories that could make you forget where you were. Growing up, my cousins and I would spend summers at her place near Lesser Slave Lake, and every evening after dinner, we'd gather around her old wood stove while she shared tales from her childhood and the stories her own elders had passed down. She must have told us hundreds of stories over those summers. Most were teaching stories, clever rabbits outsmarting wolves, or cautionary tales about respecting the land. But there were these four stories she only told us once, all on the same night when I was 12. It was late August 1998, I remember that clearly, and there were five of us kids there. Me, my younger sister Melanie, and our cousins Trev, Chrissy, and Merrill. The first three stories that night were different from her usual ones, a bit creepier, I'd say. The first was short, about 5 minutes, about this trapper who got lost in a blizzard and followed what he thought were human footprints, only to realize too late they were walking in circles and whatever made them was no human. The second was longer, about a whole family that disappeared from a fishing camp, leaving behind only their clothes laid out perfectly, as if they had just vanished from inside them. The third story took maybe 20 minutes. It was about these two brothers, hunting moose in early winter, who found a camp that should not have existed. Fresh fire still smoking, food half eaten, but covered in frost like it had been frozen mid-bite. They ran when they heard something massive circling their own camp that night, breathing like a windstorm. But it was the fourth story that struck me. I swear Grandma Eva's voice changed, like she was bracing herself. I remember her looking at the windows repeatedly, even though the curtains were drawn.
"This happened to my Uncle Joseph," she began. "Your great-great-uncle. He's been gone 40 years now, but he told me this himself when I was about Krishi's age."
She said Uncle Joseph had been working at a logging camp way up north, past high level, in the winter of 1951. The camp was small, maybe 15 men, and they were cutting timber in an area that the local Diné people had warned them about.
"The Diné elder who came to the camp, he told the foreman that the place was cursed," Grandma said. "There was something wrong there, something old. The foreman, well, he just laughed, said they weren't superstitious."
For the first 2 weeks, everything was normal. Then one of the men, a young guy named John from Quebec, went missing. He'd gone to check some traps and never came back. They searched for 3 days, but found nothing. No tracks or blood, no sign of a struggle. He was just gone.
"Uncle Joseph said the strangest thing was the quiet afterwards,"
Grandma continued.
"You know the way the forest is never truly quiet. You'll always hear the animals and the insects. But after John disappeared, there were these moments of absolute silence."
A week later, another man vanished. This time it was during the day, in broad daylight. He'd been working maybe 50 yards from the others, and when they called lunch, he didn't answer. They found his axe left in a tree, his gloves on the ground, but no footprints leading away. Nothing. The men were spooked now. A lot of them wanted to leave, but the foreman threatened to withhold their pay if they broke contract. So they stayed, but they started to work in groups, never letting anyone out of sight.
"Uncle Joseph, he started to have these dreams,"
Grandma said.
"Dreams about being hungry. So hungry it hurt. But not for food. For something else. Something warm."
2 nights after the dreams started, they heard a sound like wind through the trees, but forming words in a language that none of them recognized. It circled the camp, getting closer, then farther, then closer again. The men huddled in the main cabin, armed with whatever weapons they could find. But nothing came for them. In the morning, they found tracks, however. Big ones, and they looked like they had claws. The tracks meandered through the camp and led to each window of the cabins. Something had been watching them.
"Soon, Uncle Joseph saw it,"
Grandma said.
"He woke up, feeling as if something was telling him to peer outside the door, and he listened. There, at the edge of the lamplight, he saw John."
"But it wasn't John. Not anymore," Grandma continued.
"He was naked in the snow, skin gray-white like old ice. His mouth. Uncle Joseph said his mouth was open, so wide it looked like it had been torn, and his teeth within looked more like icicles, and he looked so very hungry. Come morning, the foreman finally agreed to abandon the camp. They packed up and left that very day, but as they were leaving, Uncle Joseph looked back and saw 3 figures at the edge of the woods. John, and the other missing man, and something else. Something thin and tall and wrong-looking even from a distance. And it watched them go."
Grandma went quiet for a moment. Then she finally said,
"The Diné elder, when they told him what happened, well, he just nodded, said they were lucky. He told them that the Wachuge, the cannibal spirit, had been feeding there for generations, said it could only take those who broke the taboo, those who had tasted human flesh or thought about it too hard when they were desperate. But once it took you, you became like it, always hungry and hunting. We didn't sleep well that night. Even back in Edmonton, I'd dream about John scratching at windows, asking me to let him in. I mostly forgot about the story as I got older. University, work, marriage. Life goes on like that. But early 2019, I remembered it again, because that's when I stumbled upon the Missing 411 series. And I couldn't help but think about the way some of those stories went. The way people seemed to just evaporate in thin air. The strange weather conditions. Clothes being found folded neatly. I know it sounds crazy, but I do wonder if maybe the Wichuge had something to do with it. If you believe in that kind of thing. Don't drive drunk, kids. From R.B. Jozzles. I've been sober for years now, not a drop since October 2021. People always ask what made me finally quit after 15 years of a little more than steady drinking, and I usually just say I had a wake-up call. That's true enough, but I don't usually go into detail about what kind of wake-up call it was. In 2021, on a Thursday, I remember because I'd just gotten paid and blew a decent chunk of money at a bar, I started to drink around 4 p.m., and I told myself I'd stop at 7. Then I said it would be 8, then 9. You know how it goes. Well, I guess I hope you don't know how it goes. By the time I stumbled out to my truck around 11, the rational part of my brain, or what was left of it, knew that I shouldn't be driving. But then the drunk part of my brain was like, come on, it's only 20 minutes up the highway, and you drive better drunk. That's a lie. No one does. But then I thought about how it was rural Alberta, middle of the night, barely any traffic. I thought, what could happen? I remember I could barely hold on to my keys. The engine turned over. I recall thinking the yellow lines looked weird, like they were moving. And then I blacked out. I'm pretty sure I did, because my memory is blank there entirely. And what I remember next was that the world was all wrong. Everything was upside down. There was this rhythmic dripping sound, too. My head felt like someone had taken a sledgehammer to it. It took me about 10 seconds to realize I was hanging from my seatbelt, and there was blood running from somewhere on my scalp, dripping up or down, I guess, onto the roof of the cab. The windshield was spiderwebbed but intact. Through it, I could see dirt and grass where the sky should be. My truck had gone off the road, near the river overpass, and rolled down the embankment. I was honestly lucky to be alive. Somehow, the headlights were still on. I started to call for help, but the sounds that came from my mouth were more like croaks. My throat was extremely dry and pained, and talking made my head hurt worse. This went on for about 15 to 20 minutes, before I noticed movement through the window to my side. I thought, thank God, someone found me. Someone had seen my accident and came down to help. I tried to turn my head to look properly, but it sent a spike of pain through my neck. But I turned enough to see a face. This face was pressed against the glass, staring at me, pale as snow, completely hairless. The features were nearly human, nose and mouth in the right general shape, but it gave off that uncanny valley vibe. The mouth was just a line with no lips, and Christ, it had solid black eyes, not even a hint of white, just black from edge to edge. But the antlers were what made me really start to panic. They grew up from its temples, not huge like a mature buck's antlers, but maybe 8 inches each side, with 3 or 4 points, like they had been pushed through from inside its skull.
Oh, I really screamed then. Not a call for help, just pure terror. The thing didn't react. It just kept staring from those eyes like oil pits. Then, almost gracefully, it moved out of view. I thrashed against the seatbelt, trying to break free, but I was stuck solid. The belt had locked up in the crash and I was hanging upside down and injured. I couldn't get the right angle to release it. I then began to hear movement behind the truck. Through the back window, I could see shapes. Legs, maybe. But bent weird. Like maybe they had too many joints or too few. The truck shifted slightly, and I heard the metal groan. Something had climbed onto the undercarriage.
"Get away!" I screamed. "Get the heck away from me!"
The metal shifted again. I started to hear scraping sounds like nails on metal. It was working its way along the driver's side. I screamed until my throat went raw, expecting any second to see that face again, reappearing in the window. Minutes passed, 5 or maybe 10. The scraping stopped. The weight on the truck seemed to disappear. I held my breath and listened, but I didn't hear anything but the blood dripping from me and the tick of cooling metal. Suddenly, there was movement to my left. Not at the window, though, but below it, or above it, given my position. A hand reached down through the gap where the door had buckled in the crash. Thin, with extremely protruding knuckles, nails yellow like bone. It was feeling along the roof's interior, searching around. Then it started to rise, still feeling around. It took me way too long to realize it was looking for the seatbelt release. One finger began to trace the button, almost gently. Then the whole hand wrapped around the mechanism. I remember my thoughts then. If it presses that button, it's gonna drag me out of here and I'll be dead. The hand tightened its grip, and then I was nowhere again. There was just blackness. I blacked out again. The worst possible moment in my life. Or would it be the second worst possible moment? What I remember after that is voices. Real human voices. Flashlight beams cutting through the cab. Someone was saying, "Sir, can you hear me?" over and over. When I looked over, I saw firefighters. Apparently, a passing truck had seen my headlights in the ditch and called it in. They used the jaws of life to pry open my door. The same door that hand had reached through. They said I was lucky to be alive. The truck had rolled 3 times, landed upside down. I could have been crushed, I could have broken my neck. Especially, they said, with how I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Yep, when they found me, my seatbelt was no longer connected, and gravity had done its job. The thing is, I remember wearing that seatbelt, even before the nightmare vision of that creature around the truck. I remember putting on the seatbelt when I was driving away from that bar. Well, the cops gave me a DUI, obviously. I lost my license, paid a massive fine, and I did some community service. But I never took another drink. Not after all that. Not after nearly dying, probably twice, and either having the worst hallucination of my entire life, or actually witnessing something that shouldn't exist. Something that almost successfully pulled me from my truck before people could find me. Clarence's Estate. From Nimes. Uncle Clarence was the family mystery. Left for Alaska in 1974, sent a Christmas card maybe every 5 years, never visited. When the lawyer called about his estate, I had to ask Mom to remind me which uncle he was. "The hermit," she said. "The one who got strange after Vietnam. He'd left me everything. Not out of love. I'd met him exactly once, at Grandma's funeral when I was 7. But I was the only one in the family without kids, without a real career, without ties. Maybe he figured I was the only one who might actually go up there to deal with his property. He was right. The house sat 40 miles outside Fairbanks, at the end of a dirt road that turned into a suggestion of a road after the first 10 miles. November wasn't the ideal time to handle an estate, but the lawyer said waiting until spring meant paying thousands in taxes and maintenance. So I flew up, rented a truck, and drove out to see what Uncle Clarence had left behind. The place was bigger than I'd expected, a real log house, not some thrown-together cabin. Solar panels on the roof, big propane tank, greenhouse attached to the south side. He'd been serious about living out there. Inside was neat, organized, like he'd known he was dying and had tidied up first. The lawyer had mentioned papers, said Clarence had been particular about me reading them before deciding what to do with the place. I found them in a filing cabinet in his study. 43 years of journals, weather logs, and what he called occurrence records. The weather logs were what you'd expect. Temperature, precipitation, wind. Detailed but boring. The journals were sparse, mostly notes about repairs, supply runs, books he'd read. But the occurrence records, those were different. December 1974, his first winter there. Short entry about finding tracks near the house after a storm. Said they looked human, but the stride was rather long. And they came from the north, where there was nothing but wilderness for 100 miles. February 1975. He heard someone calling his name during a blizzard, but he knew it couldn't be real. The nearest neighbor was 15 miles away, and nobody knew he was out there yet. But it sounded exactly like his sister. My mom. November 1975. Saw it for the first time. Just a glimpse during a whiteout. Tall figure walking past the windows. Walking, not struggling against the wind like any normal person would be. Left no tracks where it should have. The entries went on like that. Some winters, nothing. Others, multiple incidents. 1981 seemed particularly bad. Things scratching at the walls. Something trying the doors. A face at the window that wasn't quite right. He'd drawn a sketch in the margin, but it was hard to make out. I spent the first week just reading and organizing. The house was comfortable enough. Generator worked. Wood stove heated the place fine. No cell service. But Clarence had a satellite internet setup that still functioned. I emailed Mom that I was okay, that I was cataloging everything. The first odd thing I noticed was the camera situation. Clarence had security cameras all around the property. Good ones, infrared, motion activated. But when I checked the system, huge chunks of footage were missing. Always winter footage. Always during the dates mentioned in his occurrence records. The computer showed the files had been manually deleted. By Clarence. His final journal entry was from last March, 2 months before he died. He wrote that the winter had been quiet, no occurrences. He was grateful but also worried. He said the quiet winters usually meant the next one would be worse, and he said whoever inherited the place should know that some winters, you had to be careful. Some winters it came. I found his camera equipment in a closet. Professional stuff. Telephoto lenses, night vision attachments, but no photos of anything unusual. Plenty of wildlife shots, landscapes, but nothing of what he'd been recording for decades. There was a box of exposed film that had been soaked in something and ruined. Deliberate, by the look of it. The second week, I started noticing things myself. Small stuff. Sounds that weren't quite wind. Shadows moving past windows that weren't quite trees. The motion lights triggering when nothing was there. I told myself it was just being alone in a strange place. Reading too many of Clarence's records. But then I found the basement, not mentioned in any of the house documentation, hidden behind a shelf in the pantry. Clarence had converted it into something like a panic room, reinforced door, independent air supply, enough food and water for weeks. One wall was different. Clarence had drawn a map of the property and surrounding area. Red X marks at various spots, all dated. I cross-referenced with his occurrence records. The X marks were sightings. They formed a rough circle around the house, getting closer over the years. The most recent ones were right at the property line. That night, I heard my phone ringing, which was impossible. No cell service out there. But it rang and rang. When I finally found it, the screen showed Mom calling. I answered. Silence, then breathing, then Mom's voice, but wrong. Like someone had recorded her and was playing it back at the wrong speed. It said my name. Said I should come outside. Said she was cold. I didn't go outside. I went to the basement instead, locked myself in. Spent the night reading more of Clarence's records, understanding why he'd built this room, why he'd deleted the footage, why he'd destroyed the photos. He'd figured something out over the years. The thing, because that's all he ever called it, the thing, it learned, adapted. If you photographed it, it knew. If you filmed it, it would find ways to corrupt the files. Or worse, appear at your door the next night. If you told people, tried to prove it existed, it got aggressive. But if you just documented quietly, just for yourself, and stayed inside during the bad nights, you could survive. At least, that's what he ended up believing. Some winters, it didn't come at all. Some winters, it came every night for weeks. No pattern he could ever work out. Just chance. Just weather. Just whatever drove it down from wherever it lived up north. I found Clarence's final recording, an audio file on his computer from February. His voice, tired but calm. He said he was sick. Cancer. Probably wouldn't make it to summer. Said he was leaving the place to whoever would come, because someone should know. Someone should watch. Not to fight it or film it or prove it exists. Just to know. To document. To warn the next person. He said the thing had been coming around for as long as the native families could remember. They had different names for it, different stories, but all agreed on one thing. It had been here first, would be here last. The best you could do was respect it, stay out of its way, and hope it moved on. I stayed another week. Three more occurrences. Scratching on the north wall that lasted for hours. Something walking on the roof, despite the steep pitch. And on my last night, a knock at the door. Polite, almost formal. Three knocks, pause, three more. I didn't answer. Stayed in the basement until dawn, then packed everything valuable and drove out. Listed the property with a Fairbanks realtor the next day. Priced to sell fast. The buyer was a couple from California looking for a remote retreat. Off-grid living, they said. Perfect isolation. I gave them all of Clarence's journals except the occurrence records. Told them the basement was for storms. Didn't mention that some storms walked on two legs. They seemed thrilled with the place. Said they'd move in after the holidays, spend their first winter getting acclimated. I wished them luck. Meant it. Maybe their winters would be quiet. Maybe the thing had moved on, maybe. That night in the hotel, I read through Clarence's final journal one more time. The one where he'd written, in shaky handwriting, his last observation. That it was getting bolder, coming closer. That 40 years of coexistence hadn't made it friendlier, just more patient. That some winters, when the storms came from the north, and the temperatures dropped below 40, you could hear it learning to speak, practicing with the voices of everyone who'd disappeared over the years, getting better at sounding human. The couple emailed me last week, said they love the place, said the quiet is amazing, said they've been hearing the strangest sounds at night, probably just the house settling. I didn't write back. I burned Clarence's journals before leaving Alaska. All of them. The occurrence records, the weather logs, everything, stood out in the snow behind the realtor's office and watched 43 years of documentation turn to ash. Clarence's Estate, from Nimes. The Nightmare That Changed Everything, from Summon. When I was 8 years old, my stepdad left. That was 23 years ago, and I still can't sleep with my bedroom door open. We lived outside Colville, Washington, in this old farmhouse my mom rented for cheap, because it was so far away from anything else. It was just us, the Kettle River, and miles of pine forest. Mom worked at the reservation clinic, and my stepdad, I called him Boba, not sure why, just did, he did construction when he could find it. Boba was all right. Better than all right, actually. My real dad split when I was 2, so Boba was all I knew. He'd been with Mom since I was 4, and he used to take me fishing at Sullivan Lake. He would buy me comics even when Mom said we couldn't afford it, and he taught me card tricks. He had this thick Boston accent and called everyone Buddy. He was a good guy. Quiet, but good. In winter one year, we had this unexpected warm snap. Then the temperature crashed again, leaving everything covered in a crust of ice. The power kept flickering on and off, and Mom had to keep the fireplace going with wood all night. That night I had this dream about drowning. Oddly enough, not in water, but in snow. It was filling up my mouth, my nose, my lungs, and I was trying to scream, but nothing came out. I woke up gasping, sheets soaked with sweat, even though it was so cold in the house. Our house was small. There was my room, Mom and Boba's room, one bathroom, kitchen, living room, and that was it. Their bedroom was maybe 15 feet from mine, straight down the hall. They usually kept their door closed. Not locked, just closed. Mom said it helped keep the heat in. But that night it was open, maybe 6 inches, enough to see a slice of darkness beyond. I sat there in bed for a while, trying to shake off that stupid dream. I got up, barefoot on cold floorboards, and I walked down the hallway. It was dark enough that I had to put my hand on the wall to guide myself. It was then that I started to hear breathing, like rapid breathing. When I got to the door and started to push it open, I called, "Mama?" The curtains were open in their room. Mom always left them that way. She liked waking up to the sunlight. Moonlight came through in this bright silver rectangle, landing on their bed. Mom was asleep on the far side, peacefully. She was turned away from me, just a bump under the quilts. But Bobo was sitting up, rigid as a fence post. His eyes were wide and reflecting the moonlight. And when I looked closer, I swear he was crying. There were tears down his face. His whole body was shaking. Not like a cold shake either, but like he was holding himself still with everything he had. "Boba?" I whispered. His lips moved. I think he said, "Buddy," but I can't be sure. Even if he did say "Buddy," what came out of his mouth sounded like a warning, and that really scared me. He didn't even look at me, didn't blink at all. He stared at the far corner of the room, the one where the moonlight wasn't touching. I didn't want to look. My 8-year-old mind said, "Don't look over there. Just go back to bed." But I looked anyway. That corner wasn't empty. There was a person there. Well, it was shaped like a person. It was tall and had to duck its head slightly where the ceiling sloped down. Its skin was pale like paper, like nothing I'd ever seen. It stood perfectly still with its arms at its sides, facing the bed, staring at Boba. I couldn't see its face clearly in the shadows, thankfully. But I could see its hands. Strange zombie-like hands, is what I remember thinking as a kid. The worst part was how still it was. Not motionless like it was trying not to be seen, but still like it didn't need to move. Like it could just wait there forever if it wanted to. Boba made a sound then, a small broken noise, like when you're trying not to cry in front of someone. I backed out of the room, slow, careful, like when you see a wasp and don't want to startle it. I made it to the hallway and closed their door as quietly as I could, leaving it exactly how I'd found it. I went back to my room. I got under the covers and pulled them over my head. I did my best to convince myself it was a nightmare. The thing about being 8 years old is you can make yourself believe almost anything if you try hard enough. I lay there under the blankets, breathing my own hot air, until somehow I fell asleep. When I woke up, it was past 10. Mom was in the kitchen, and she was crying. Not loudly, just sitting at the table with tears rolling down her face.
"Where's Boba?" I asked.
She looked at me before answering.
"He had to go, baby."
"Where did he go?" I asked.
"Just away. He needed to go away."
I only found out later, years later, that he had left in the middle of the night. Packed one bag, took his truck, and drove off. He left a note that said, "I'm sorry. I can't stay. Please take care of Buddy." Mom tried calling him. His brother back in Boston and his friends and his old job sites knew nothing. It was like he vanished. Not like a missing person case, but just went to live a completely different life. His brother finally told Mom that Boba had called once to say that he was okay, but could not come back, and he wouldn't say why. Mom never understood. She thought maybe he had been seeing someone else, or maybe the pressure of being a stepdad was just getting to him. One of any of the usual reasons men leave. She remarried when I was 12, a nice insurance salesman who was normal, and we moved to Spokane, and life went on. But to this day, I think I know what happened. I had seen what was in that corner, and more importantly, I had seen Boba's face. That wasn't the face of a man who wanted to leave. That was the face of a man who had seen something that broke a piece of him. Something that made staying impossible. Well, that brings us to a sort of early end to this episode. My apologies for not being able to fill out a full hour this time. But I've been wanting to do Wichuge stories for a while. Ever since people were telling me that Wichuges and Wendigos were getting mixed up and fused together. But to me, they sound sort of like the same thing, but through different cultural interpretations. That's just my opinion, and I think both creatures are incredibly cool and creepy. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Unexplained Encounters. I've been your host, Darkness Prevails. And if you haven't already, follow me on Twitter at Dark Prevails. Pre-order my book, Creepy Campfire Stories, which comes out July 8th. Send us your scary stories of the unexplained at darkstories.org. And follow and review Unexplained Encounters on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thank you. Until next time, everyone, stay safe out there and stay creepy, because this world is a strange one.